abide in the emptiness behind the mind, deeper within than thoughts can reach. In the space of timeless presence. In the space of worldless, immediacy, in the luminous void, of the Supreme Reality. Feel the freedom of boundarylessness, of infinite spaciousness, of freedom from identity and determinacy. Be absorbed into the freedom of the uncreated intelligence. Abide as the formless presence without a past, without a future, that never changes, with neither beginning nor end. Abide in that state, in that realm in which there is no karma, no maya, no suffering, no I and no other. Abide in that state in which only the self is. And whatever appears is simply an internal movement of the ocean of consciousness. Waves within the silent sea. But the sea never changes. And the relative is not different from the absolute. The self has no story, no narrative, no destiny, no fall, no redemption, nothing to gain, nothing to lose. And is forever in perfect peace. Abide in the acceptance. That there is only the self. Whether the body is sitting or is active, whether the mind is still or agitated, the self never changes, is never affected. Is never decentered. Is never attached to any phenomenal event. And the self is never in bondage to the emotions of the ego. Abiding in the self is the victory of the real over the unreal, that raises even the unreal into the meaning moreness of the supreme intelligence. Abide as pure and total consciousness. Aware of the inner meaning of all that becomes and all that disappears. And all that points from the unreal to the real. Shiva. Paramashiva. Parashakti. Parabrahman. Buddha. Allah. Cristo, Krishna, Tao, Om Namah Shivaya, Shiva. Om Shivoham. Om Tat Sat. Namaste. Welcome to our visitors. Joy to see your shining faces and the energy of your souls and the beautiful assortment of our soul family of the Sangha, working together and integrating in such beautiful cooperative symbiosis as a super organism. And it's a great joy to have this gathering this evening, even though some of you may have preferred a movie. But we'll try to make this as interesting an alternative as possible, and we'll have a movie next week, so not to worry. But there are a few things to announce and to talk about, that this was the only evening possible to do that. So one of the things that I think we would benefit from understanding as deeply as possible is that of Maya and the laws of karma. And the laws of karma operate in the realm of Maya. They don't operate beyond the realm of Maya. And Maya, of course, is illusion. But that illusion is very tenacious, as we know, and it's not that difficult to fall into it if one's consciousness gets projected into the phenomenal plane and mistakes it for reality. And I wanted to point out that we've been talking in the retreat about the three types of reasoning that logicians recognize, right? Inductive, deductive, and abductive. But there's a fourth type of reasoning that is the one that humans actually use. It's none of those three. That's what you use, you know, on philosophy exams or something. In real life, what I call the fourth type of logical reasoning is not inductive or abductive, but it's madductive. I would even call it mad duct tape reasoning, because we try to hold it together through a mad kind of hypothesis, right? So there's a kind of normal madness that people actually employ to make their decisions in life. They don't do it based on reasoning. Okay, so I think we all know that. But it might be important to actually study what madductive reasoning is and how it functions and why it's although it's mad, it's also, it brings one to a sense of certainty that one is doing the will of God. Right, because one feels totally lost and not sure what to do, and it's only this kind of madductive superposition on the unfoldment of events that can bring it to a conclusion in which one feels like I couldn't have done anything else, right? And everyone wants to feel that way in order to be able to accept the unfoldment of their fate. So I want to quote from a passage from an excellent book that I think is actually a storehouse of insights about the law of karma. It's called Living by the Words of Bhagavan. It's the story of Anamalai Swami, who is one of the chief disciples of Sri Ramana Maharshi. And he came at a very early point after the establishment of the ashram in Tiruvannamalai, and he ended up being appointed by Ramana to be the builder of most of the buildings. He constructed them. And what's interesting about Anamalai to start with is that when he was born in a village maybe 40 miles or so away from Tiruvannamalai, A traveling Brahmin fortune teller told his parents that he was destined to be a sadhu. And his parents were horrified by this because they wanted him to have a job and make money, you know, and be, you know, they didn't want him to be wandering out there begging for dinner and all of that. So they did everything possible to dissuade him from being a sadhu and being spiritual. And the father wanted him to follow in his footsteps, and he was a builder. He was a constructionist, and you know, and he built houses. And the last thing Anamalai ever wanted to do was build houses. So here he does. He becomes a sadhu, and he ends up having to build the buildings and the ashram. So you see how the law of karma doesn't let you escape, you know, from your destiny. But at the same time, there's a kind of mad congruence between your destiny and your fate, right? How they come together. And so in his acceptance of the fact that he was doing what he hated doing and yet doing what he loved doing simultaneously, he was unable to separate those two aspects of reality, which are always bugging the ego, and finally coming to a resolution in which he could totally accept. But it took him a while. So I want to read this passage about that happened in the early days when he first came to the ashram, and he was not happy there. So let me find this passage. Okay. This was, if you have the book, on page 30. I was, not that you have the book here, but you might have it on your bookshelf and want to go back and check it. Some of you might have it. Synchronicities do happen. I was very happy to have found such a great guru as Bhagavan. As soon as I saw him, I felt I was looking at God himself. However, initially I was not very impressed, either by the ashram or by the devotees who had gathered around him. The management seemed to be very autocratic, and most of the devotees didn't seem to have much interest in the spiritual life. So far as I could see, they were primarily interested in gossiping. Now, you can't relate to that here, can you? None of us gossip or have any unspiritual attitudes, but hey, that was Ramana's ashram. So Anamalai goes on scandalously, "These early impressions disturbed me. I thought to myself, Bhagavan's very great, but if I live in the company of these people, I may lose the devotion that I already have." This laughter disturbs me a little bit. "I came to the conclusion that it would not be spiritually beneficial for me to associate with people who didn't seem to have much devotion. I know now that this was a very arrogant attitude, but those were my true feelings at the time. These thoughts disturbed me so much that for 3 or 4 nights I was unable to sleep. I finally came to the conclusion that I would keep Bhagavan as my guru, but I would live somewhere else." "I remember thinking, I will go and do meditation on the self somewhere else, without having the distracting friendship of any human beings. I will go to an unknown place and meditate on God. I will go for bhiksha, which means begging for food, and I'll lead a solitary life," right? Live in a cave and be a real sadhu, right? "I remember thinking..." So about 3 weeks after I first came to the ashram, I left to take up my new life. So it was only there 3 weeks, and poof, gone, right? So, "I told no one, not even Bhagavan, about my decision. I left at 1 a.m. on a full moon night and started to walk toward town. I went straight through the town, past Esanya Math, which is a monastic institution, northeast of Tiruvannamalai, and I started walking toward Polur. I had no particular destination in mind. I just wanted to get away from the ashram. I spent the whole night walking and reached Polur, which is a village about 20 miles north of Tiruvannamalai, just after dawn. The walk had made me very hungry, So I decided to go for bhiksha in the town. It was not a great success. I begged at about 500 different houses, but no one gave me any food. That's very unusual in India at that time. One man told me that I should go back to Tiruvannamalai, while another man, who was serving a meal when I approached him, shouted at me, telling me to go away. Eventually, I gave up and walked to the outskirts of the town. I found a well in a field, and I spent about a half hour standing in it, with the water up to my neck, hoping that the coldness of the water would take my hunger pains away. It didn't work. You see a little maddictive reasoning already starting to take over, right? Then I made my way to the samadhi, which is a shrine where the corpse or the cremated remains of a saint are. I went to the samadhi of Vitoba, who was a saint who had died recently in that town, and sat there for a while. I finally got something to eat when an old lady came to do puja. She looked at me and she said, "It seems as if you are very hungry. Your eyes are starting to sink into your face. I don't have much myself, but I can give you some ragi." That's millet gruel. And it's not very good, believe me. It's, you know, you'd have to be starving to want to eat it. As she was saying this, she gave me about 1.5 tumblers of this ragi gruel to drink. It didn't do much for my hunger pangs, but I was still happy to receive it. The long walk and the lack of food had made me very tired. As I sat there, I began to question the wisdom of leaving Bhagavan. It was clear that things had not turned out in the way that I had expected. This indicated to me that the decision might not have been correct. I formulated a plan which I thought would test whether my decision had been correct or not. I took a large handful of flowers, placed them on the samadhi of Vitoba, and started to remove them two at a time. I had decided in advance that if there were an odd number of flowers, I would return to Bhagavan. If there were an even number, I would carry on with my original plan. When the result indicated that I should go back to Bhagavan, I immediately accepted the decision and started walking toward Tiruvannamalai. How many of you have ever made a decision on the basis of something like that? Well, there's a few honest, maddictive yogis here. So his karma did seem to indicate that he would be better off going back and that he was going to have a very hard time doing that, living out of the ashram as he desired. Did he make that decision based on a rational understanding of reality, or was it a non-rational giving into superstition? Well, he goes on. Once I had accepted that my prarabdha, my destiny, was to stay with Bhagavan, my luck began to change. As I was walking into town, a hotel owner invited me into his hotel and gave me a free meal and even gave me some money. Okay. He even prostrated to me. You know, he bowed to me as if I was like an enlightened saint, right? So I had decided to return to Tiruvannamalai by train because I wanted to get back as soon as possible. But before I could reach the station, some more people invited me into their house and asked me to eat. I ate a little food there and then excused myself on the grounds that I had just already eaten a big meal. I decided to try to travel without a ticket, because I wrongly assumed that the money I had been given wouldn't be enough for the journey. My good luck continued on the train. Halfway to Tiruvannamalai, a ticket inspector came to inspect all the tickets. I seemed to be invisible to him, for I was the only person in the carriage who was not asked to produce a ticket. A similar thing happened at the end of the journey. When I paused in front of the ticket collector on the station platform, he said, "You've already given your ticket. Go. You're holding up the other people in the line." So then, by Bhagavan's grace, I escaped on both occasions without having to pay, right? So I walked the remaining distance of to the ashram. On my arrival, I went straight to Bhagavan, prostrated before him, and told him everything that happened. Bhagavan confirmed it was my destiny to stay at Ramanashraman. He said, you have work to do here. If you try to leave without doing the jobs you're destined for, you, where can you go? Right? Okay. So, that's how karma works. Okay? Now, he was pretty certain, by the way he was treated on the way back, as if he was already, you know, an enlightened being and given all kinds of miraculous help, that he had made the right decision. So he had no doubts, right? So karma will work that way. But does it work that way because of external forces, or was it his own projections and his own attitude and his own subconscious conflict with the act of leaving the ashram that had produced the difficulties leaving and all of the great events of support that he got on coming back, right? So a psychoanalyst would obviously analyze this event differently than would a mystic or a yogi. But nonetheless, this is the kind of event that determines the course of our lives rather than any kind of a logical process of deciding the pros and cons of some program, right? So I think that understanding how Maya works and how we are participants in the creation of the events without realizing that we are, and then getting the feedback from the phenomenal plane that is actually expressing our innermost yearning that integrates and brings to fruition a melding of the conflicting drives in the conscious and subconscious with our superconscious destiny is what brings wholeness. If we don't resist it, if we actually obey the signs and wonders that we are given from the world as a message that comes from God, or is the way that the Tao is unfolding. So there's a kind of sanity that comes from being mad, and that alone can bring one into a state of harmony with one's world and one's conditions of life, and a full acceptance of how it unfolds in perfection, without a constant sense of doubt. Should I be here? Should I go? Should I do something else? So he was fortunate that destiny would not let him leave. The unfortunate ones are those who do get to leave without being stopped and then have to discover things along the way that they might have learned more easily at the ashram. But nonetheless, everyone's destiny comes out of their individual relationship to the world and to their own internal drive complexes that create reality as with a look that brings about a kind of a compromise between the positive and the negative, right? Between the seeing what is good in a situation and seeing what is bad, and making a decision of, does the bad outweigh the good, or does the cons outweigh the pros that would cause me to make a decision to go elsewhere or to do something else other than what I had thought would be my destiny. So this is the kind of question that's always going on somehow in the subtext of every ego mind. And until that kind of internal disharmony can be resolved, one doesn't have a peaceful relationship to one's unfoldment of one's life. So yoga will give you that peace if you can be in acceptance with the madductive responsibility to interpret the signs in a way that will serve your highest unfoldment of surrender to the will of God, even if that will looks like it is presented in a way that is non-rational. But by following the clues that the world is giving you, you will get a strong sense of what the Tao is opening to you and what windows of opportunity you should leap through and which ones you should close and say no thanks to. And those kinds of intuitions are part of what develops when the soul becomes more sensitive to the nature of how reality is reflected in appearance. So that brings me to the next announcement, which is that we're doing a very soft launch of a new book, so soft that it's weightless and isn't really even happening. But the second volume of the Gems of Wisdom series of the collected essays that were done, you know, starting back in 2002 and 3, we're now in volume 2. And I had to get it out of my space so I could go on. So I have no emotional relation to this book, and it's very odd because it's a very emotion-filled book. But it's just something that has passed through that has to be given, and I think it may be helpful to some people, but. It is, because it's a book about Maya, really, and about the overcoming of Maya, but mostly about the way that Maya functions in the life of the ego, and even of the soul level of consciousness. It's a book that I think one has to, one can benefit from appreciating. And in the same way that one outgrows frames of reference or paradigms of life and enters into more spacious and more deep and more meaningful ones, I think that the reading of the book may serve someone to let go of their own veils and unveil the real behind whatever is the pattern of belief that is motivating the consciousness to think of itself as a certain kind of person in a certain kind of world, and to recognize that all of that is projected and none of it is based on the real. It's based on thought patterns. So the Seven Veils of Maya is the title. And the subtitle is Eldritch Essays by this character called Shunyamurti. Now, I want to explain this word eldritch and why I chose it. It's an old word, and it comes originally from Elfreich. Okay, meaning the kingdom of the elves. In other words, it comes from an enchanted world, a world that is filled with beings who are magical. And the essays in this volume come from Greek mythology. And Greek mythology is filled with all kinds of nymphs, water nymphs and woodland nymphs, and of course there are sirens, and you have in Olympus you have not only the gods, but you have the graces and the muses, and you have semi and demigods and all kinds of hybrids, and of course you have Poseidon, the ocean god, and you have Thanatos, the lord of death, and you have the rulers of the underworld, Hades and Persephone. So you have a world filled with magical beings. And I chose Greek mythology rather than Indian mythology to use as the basis of trying to explain the developmental process of the human through the different veils of Maya that one goes through as one's consciousness deepens and one perceives the magical nature of the world, but then passes through that into a more non-magical and scientific kind of mode of perception, and then transcends even that into a more metaphysical analytic kind of consciousness at the end of Kali Yuga, in which there's a linguistic turn and one is recognizing that the world is based on representations, but that the signifiers of language are always sliding over the signified, and one doesn't always know what they mean by what they say and what they think. And so one becomes aware of the confusions even within rational thought, because the connection between what you think and what those thoughts actually mean and refer to within the plane of Maya are in a state of slippage and indeterminacy. They are not as certain as we tend to want to believe. And so we are led into cognitive errors through actually accurate thinking, but we're basing the thinking on the words and not on the reference of those words. So we can be confused if someone tells us they're giving us a vaccine when the word vaccine now means something very different. It now means, right, a genetically modifying device that'll put microchips and nanobots into you. But the word vaccine doesn't tend to mean that to people. And so if they assume that the signifier refers to its old signified, they may make an error in judgment, right? So it is the play between these two planes of representation that ruling elites tend to use in order to develop mind control over subjects who have a tendency to have a naive relationship with language and can easily be manipulated by signifiers that sound good. Democracy may sound good, but that signifier now tends to mean arbitrary tyranny. But, you know, we're still in the free world. That means we're enslaved, you know. But the signifiers are accurate if you understand what they mean. Indeed, the injections are safe and effective if what your goal is depopulation. So you can, the recognition of the relationship of these levels of signifier and signified that will give you an understanding of how you have to respond to the various calls of the media and the Big Brother in advising you as to what to do and how to live. So I used Greek mythology rather than Indian because, you know, we've all seen the Mahabharata film recently, and the logos of ancient India is very different from the logos of ancient Greece. They do have things in common. They're both magical worlds. But in ancient Greece, you wouldn't have a wife, blindfolding herself in order to be in resonance with a blind husband, you know, and share his blindness. She would instead want to be his eyes and take care of him, and right? Or else, you know, leave him. But she would at least not want to blind herself. She would follow an entirely different logic in her way of relating to disability, let's say, and to the dharma of loyalty. And in many ways, the kind of dharmic intentionality in ancient India did not carry over into the Greek world, even though the Greek world is an Aryan split-off community. But nonetheless, they, because of their nomadic nature and because they became a seafaring culture living on Greek isles, their actual relationship to reality became very different than an agricultural society in a landlocked area. And the Greek, not just the logos, but the umwelt, became the basis of European social development, and this led to what in modern times became colonialism and imperialism and technological development, because there was a will to power that was present within the Greek culture in which there was a lot of warfare, much more so, even though the Mahabharata is about a war. But nonetheless, the culture was a very literally Spartan in its formation of a social order as a war machine. And so that kind of an appropriation of techne, even within a magical context, was already present within ancient Greece. And it's that attitude that became the basis of the possessive tendencies, the greed, the tendency of control of territory, etc., that we are, of course, still dealing with in a much more complicated way today. But I felt that because of the Europeanization of the globe and through the globalization of capitalism in the end of Kali Yuga, that this was a model of intellectual development that was more relatable to readers in the West. And the different mythological constructs were the equivalent of modern psychoanalysis. In fact, it's no accident that Freud stole from Greek mythology his main concepts, right? The narcissism from the myth of Narcissus, the Oedipus complex, etc. They came from there, and Carl Jung stole even more from the Greek mythological tradition as representing our own archetypal subconscious. And so there is a through line between modern depth psychology and the ancient mythological psychology that was taught in a different way, but was, I think, even more descriptive and more effective in its presentation of how a complex affects one's life course. And so what I did, and originally, back in 2004, for the most part, was I wrote five of these essays, and I've extracted them from all the other essays written in that period because they shared that theme. But I added the final two that were never actually posted back then, and they are not mythological because they are the point where consciousness leaves mythology and enters metaphysics and takes the linguistic turn into the logos and the ontos, the drive to understand one's being, not one's becoming. And so this is a kind of arc of development of consciousness to its final phase that we are now in at the end of the Iron Age. And because the myths are very ironic in a way, I think that's a very important concept. I would even call this not the Iron Age, but the Irony Age, because everything is totally ironic. And you know, an ironic expression says the opposite of what it means, like the vaccines are safe and effective, etc. And so there is an ironic tint to everything that you hear within the media that often is telling you the truth in the form of a lie. And very often fiction reveals much more truth than nonfiction can. And so these fictional scenarios that the Greek myths comprise are often very revealing in ways that a logical or philosophical treatise could not present. So I'm hoping that the book will be useful and good for a laugh or two and for an ironic understanding of one's own misdirections, misunderstandings of oneself, and that can help unveil what is implicit but never fully recognized in one's trajectory of narrative development of the representational aspect of one's ego. So I hope all of that is clear. I'm not sure if I should read anything from the book, but I guess I'll read a little bit just so you get a sense of, you know, what this is all about. And for now, the book isn't even yet in our Bhandara, so it's not, we're not selling it. But I think Monday it'll be on the in the store and the website, and we'll give it to the Sangha at that point. And I think Parvati is finishing the formatting of it. Both Vajra and Parvati are working very hard, and this book would not exist without them. Vajra's constant corrections of my horrible style as a writer were essential to bringing the book to being even readable. And I have committed so many sins of comma splicing and run-on sentences that... You know, it's prose writing is not very easy for this being, but ultimately it came to pass that I think it's a readable text. So I'll read just the beginning of the foreword so you get a sense of, you know, why this book exists and if it has a raison d'être. Truth is radical. It is so radical and so subtle, elusive, and immense that it cannot be grasped by the human mind. Artists who glimpse the absolute real are often tormented by the impossibility of adequately expressing truth in words or music or images. A few great beings have attained the full truth by passing beyond ego death into union with the absolute. Their teachings have become the founding documents of the world's great religions. Other sages have replicated those achievements and thus have succeeded in sustaining the power of truth through the defiles of history. But in the past two centuries, the collective consciousness of humanity has fallen ever further into a materialist, scientistic delusion brought about by the modern ideologies that have broken with all sacred traditions. We have come to depend on technology rather than on truth for our well-being. And now we have become enslaved to technocratic tyrannies without access to the power of truth to set ourselves free. We have arrived at the last possible moment in which we can alter our destiny in this dominion of deception and defeat the dystopia that threatens to extinguish our divine spark forever. The truth remains beyond the reach of words. Only silence can cross the chasm that separates the unreal from the real. But the ego mind denies us entry into such serenity. The mind races day and night, running from truth. Incessant mental chatter is the ego's defense against the emptiness each soul must enter and traverse to reconnect with the Godhead. But the interference pattern set up by trivial diversions and mundane muddles proves an obstacle that few surmount. Many strategies have been devised to overcome the mind's resistance to stillness. Mantras, prayers, physical exercises, breathing methods, mindfulness, and other modes of meditation have been tried, yet none of them work for most seekers. Our will is not strong enough to command the mind's obedience. So we offer here another approach, using the mind and its penchant for narratives to gradually raise our vibrational frequency and redirect our desire toward the aim of stripping away the veils of illusion. Because we live in a sea of words, we use the flow of language to recognize and relate to the inner creative imagination that stirs one's heart to quest again for the truth that can only be revealed in art. By embracing the stimulation spawned by the secret allure of the self, who abides beyond the semblance of the worldly sphere, one's awareness is ushered into the bedchamber of our Supreme Being. Here, attention is becalmed. The eye tension is relaxed and undressed until consciousness stands naked, open, undefended. This is the holy moment of rapture. The soul is ravished by the awesome power of the real. So that's the intention of the book. We'll see if you're ravished by it or not, but I hope it at least we'll get some pure jouissance out of it, and that it will help to bring you to more of an appreciation and compassion for all the souls that are trapped in a veil of Maya that they have mistaken for reality. So that's all I have to say about the book, but can we bring a chair up here? Because I'd like, Vajra is probably the only one who's really read it very many times, actually. Unfortunately, I apologize to you for that. But maybe you can say a few words about what you got out of the process. And maybe I'll ask Parvati also, since I think she struggled through the text as well. So you can give an introduction that's a little more objective than mine. So please.
I think I have all of the emotional attachment to the book. I actually wanted to say that the word eldritch, it almost didn't make it to the cover because I said, Shunya, nobody's going to know what that means. Like, everybody's going to have to look it up. And it was actually Parvati that said, no, I like it. Let's keep it. And so she won that one. She won that one. And it's a cool word, so I'm glad we did.
Thank you.
By Bhagavan's grace, I have the great fortune, or karma, of being able to help in this really beautiful process of releasing these books to the world. And tonight I thought I was going to tell the truth. And the process of unveiling this book feels like Vajra's unveiling of her own process. And it feels very, very liberating because there's literally liberating wisdom here. And Shunya just read from the foreword, which was one of the quotes I wrote down about using the mind and its penchant for narratives to gradually raise our vibrational frequency. And I feel that it's done that for me and motivated me, it's another quote, to learn the secrets of the underlying drive to dwell in fantasy, which if anybody's familiar with an ego structure, probably knows very well. At some point during the writing of this book, I actually remember it was the Mahabharata movie night. And I came home and there were some essays in my inbox. And it was in the Tantalus and the Sisyphus essays, which are the second and third veils. And Shunya wrote something about the lake of frustration that Tantalus was experiencing. You know, he goes into the lake and he tries to reach the branch and it flies away and he's thirsty and the lake sinks down to his ankles and he can't have food or drink and it's because of his poor behavior. And something about this just like struck me in the heart, and I remember that I couldn't stop crying, and I was like sure that once again he was like writing my private Maya in this book into the narratives of all of the characters. And I kind of already knew I was a narcissist, so that one didn't really bother me.
That's mad ductive reasoning right there.
But like the insatiability of Tantalus and like these drives for power of Sisyphus and like above all like these inability to love that you will read about in the first three veils. And I was just like, I felt like so exposed. And I think I'd previously written to Shunya in a different draft, like the third or fourth draft, and said, are you writing about me in these books? And he says, well, it's universal. So I was like, okay, it's universal, okay. But this time, I wrote to him and I said, it really feels like you're writing my Maya for all of the world. And he said, I am. And then I started laughing that night. Like, I just started, like, laughing. I think you're talking about laughing in the form of weeping. Like, that's exactly what it was. Like, what a cosmic joke, right? To have this expose of the ego in such a way that it's, like, literary medicine for the people. And, of course, it's, like, it's the other part of the joke. It's, like, it's narcissistic of me to think that this is actually my Maya that's on display in this book. It's everyone's Maya. Thank you for sharing. And you can't take it personally, because I think that's the biggest part of the joke is, like, there is no person. And you find this out in the end, if you didn't already know, in the epilogue, which is called The Never-Starting Story. And here's a quote from there. It says, all the veils of Maya comprise only stories within a story that no one ever told and that no one has experienced. Our never-starting story seems to contain a long past, yet it's a history that has never really happened. The past is an aspect of the present, and the present is pure imagination. So So I always love these endings. It fills me with so much peace. I know it doesn't do that for everyone, but like that we're in the end, but also that it's the beginning. And so these first three veils, they're so beautiful to read, but they're also horrible to face. That's what I experienced. And Shunya says in the foreword, actually, once we relate these mythic motifs to our own lives, we can see how we have been captured by degraded versions of the original archetypal models of divinity. When that is clearly perceived, we can remodel the misshapen patterns of our becoming and peer through them to the deeper truths our lives were intended to attain. But we may need to go through many layers of obscuration in order to reach the bedrock of our being, the radical ultimate truth. The prize is liberation from the game. And so I think this book creates what I termed a palatable understanding of one's drives, because Shunya, thankfully, always brings everything to kind of a more uplifting journey out of the lower chakras. And so, as always, it takes a lot of energy to move through these lower three chakras. I think in every teaching where there's seven steps, the first three take like, you know, 70% or even 90% of the conversation. Like, if you try to explain Maya, it takes a really long time. Like, you're trying to explain what's going on in your mind and what you thought and he said and she said and then I thought and then I did and then it was wrong and but is it right? And all of these things, like, it's just blah. So, and then we get to the Veil of Orpheus. And this one, when I was trying to kind of put onto paper my experience, it actually was the harder one. The first three was really easy to get, the ego sucks. But when I got to the fourth veil, the Veil of Divine Love, I had kind of a loss as to what really stood out for me. It's this like tragic story of the lost object of Narcissus, of Orpheus, and I'm sure we've been there at some point, but the energy actually does start to move there and get lighter, and then there's this joke about psychoanalyzing God, the psychoanalysis of God's dream, which makes you realize that even God has a dark side, like the Satan being part of the Trinity that we learned about the other night in the retreat. And I think what I finally understood was this idea about from the Bible about God being a jealous God. And Shunya says, the heart must withdraw from all projections, right? This is love. Our jealous God demands undivided adoration, which is this one-pointedness in meditation. And in its final act, love itself is raised to a higher level by the upper death drive. And so we start to kind of be lifted up within the book and move into a higher frequency. And then when I was kind of trying to decide what's my favorite story, I didn't want to look back at the first three veils anymore. And it's hard to like any of them because they're all about Maya. But the double veil of Daedalus and Icarus, it's a very cool, like, multi-layered story with a very deep meaning that reveals the creative power of the intellect and also its pitfalls. But what surprised me the most is how much Shunya changed it in this last draft of the book. I won't tell you how. But to reveal that even this higher understanding, this understanding that could literally make these guys fly and can help one get out of the labyrinth of mind, even if you get to that point, you're still not done yet. And at the end of the story, he says, one needs a lot of preparation to ride on the wondrous currents of blissful light that shine with annihilating power upon attainment of the glory of God. And this was like a very humbling lesson for me about humility and patience and listening and honoring the wisdom of the wise ones, right? Which is something I think is so important in a community like this. He spoke, I think, in the teaching about anarchy and sophiocracy, which comes from this, what I'm speaking about, of the opening of one's heart and one's mind and the humility that is required in order to actually be an apprentice and learn what it takes to be in a sophiocratic or have a place in a sophiocratic society. So I think that's a hope for this community. And so then we get to the last two veils, as Shunya was speaking about, Logos the sixth, and the language becomes more lyrical and more poetic and elevated and a little bit more slippery. And he says there's no longer a guiding mythos at this level. This is the story of the soul. And another quote, no longer interested in egoic melodramas, thankfully. The soul wants only to understand understanding itself. The Logos is the final looking glass through which our consciousness must pass. And so that's what I kind of started to calm down a lot in these veils. And oh yeah, this is what probably has been a driving force for almost everyone that's come here to this ashram, right? The trying to understand the understanding itself. And this is why we stay here and why we study, because in this lifetime, this supreme journey to understanding is available to us here in a wisdom and mystery school. And then we come to the seventh veil, which brings it all home to the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter being, we all know you do not exist. We have arrived at the long prophesied apocalyptic endgame in history. We are living in a myth that we have mistaken for reality. This myth is the holographic movie in which we are all playing roles as extras. This is the punchline that concludes the Veil of Ontos. None of this is real. The world is a fiction, a video game, a great work of art. Mm-hmm. So that quote goes on for a little while, but I'll leave it there and let you discover it. Because the icing on the cake, I think, of the book is the codicil. Is that how you say it? Mm-hmm. Which shows how the seven veils and the seven bodies reflect one another. So it actually brings back together the Kundalini yoga of ascension with the veils of Maya and their potential to unveil who then rules the world, which is the name of the postscript. And in the never-ending story, you begin it all again. So that's my introduction of the book. I skipped over the introductions so you can read them yourself. But I wondered, we started with seven essays, pretty short, and I should never have wondered how to make an entire book, how Shunya would make an entire book out of seven short essays. And so, he never fails to redream fullness out of emptiness, entire sagas out of the void, from the mind of God to every heart, uplifting souls with messages of truth until we are absorbed in the singularity again. Amen.
Now I understand the book.
There you go. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for writing.
Thank you for your editing and proofreading and pushing me to finish it. Okay. So I appreciate it.
Push you to finish the next one.
Yeah, I know. Now is the next one. So there's always another. Thank you. Barb, do you want to say a few words about the impressions the book made on you?
Looking at the book in a different light, but I had the chance to take the ride. And I would definitely say I flew through it. It wasn't even a struggle. I mean, I definitely need to read it a few more times, but I was going to read what I wrote to Shunya after I read it, but I've always loved mythology. Like as a child, I don't know how many times I read the Chronicles of Narnia, and was always like was really into Greek mythology, and like loved the sci-fi stories, Lord of the Rings, all of these things, and but was always without the context and how it applies to one's inner world. And so I found it being absolutely incredible to have the opportunity to have these things connected, to see how it relates to my own inner world. And I think this point about I loved the word, the Eldritch, how do you pronounce it?
Eldritch.
Eldritch. I didn't know the origin, but I had a feeling when trying to look it up, it was something like that. It was interesting. It was this, because these myths and these stories always have a magical sense to it, that is so lost in the ego, imaginary and real one. And I feel like that's what happened in reading it. It felt like being in a different dimension that just turned magical. At any rate, I wrote Shunya, wow, I've just finished reading through the whole of the Seven Veils. It is incredible. This is my favorite publication so far. I was just taken on a magical mystery of myths and metaphors into the depths of consciousness, psycho-spiritual growth, and lifted into the ethereal. What a blessing to delve into and learn how to apply these lessons to myself to get to higher self, and even that is a veil. Still, I seem to experience, quote-unquote, frustrations, how these veils blind when it is time to stand humbly naked and unfurled. I had no idea the actual plot and unfoldment of some of these myths. Your writing is absolutely captivating. The storytelling into the myth, just like, it's incredible. And I found myself laughing out loud on multiple occasions. And as Vajra touched on in the codicil, I think my favorite line was, the Dharma ordains that only God can know God, no duality can enter the Holy of Holies. It was incredible to get to read it. So thank you for writing it. And I was going to share more just from the front matter, and what is a veil and how to pierce a veil, but I'll just leave it at that. Definitely a gift. So
thank you, Parvati. Okay, so the book will be available Monday, and then I think we'll put some page on the website to announce it, and hopefully it'll go to Amazon soon after that, and then we'll do a real launch. But what I would like is, if people do enjoy the book and want to make a comment, we could have some like testimonials or critiques or whatever on the webpage. So feel free to send those to Vajra, and we'll design a page to warn people about the book. So anyway, we have a few minutes left. I want to open the floor if anyone has any comments or questions about Anamalai Swami or about Greek mythology or maddductive reasoning or anything else that comes to your mind. Please feel free. Swati.
I have two questions. One has to do with the initial teaching. And you mentioned about the congruence between destiny and fate, these being two aspects of reality that bug the ego, that have come to a resolution in the story that you told. Can you explain a little bit more about that? And then I have a question about something that Vajra quoted from the book.
Well, destiny, in a sense, is the destination of the soul, which wants to return to God. So he was with the guru that could bring him there, but he was also in a very unpleasant situation that he wanted to get out of, right? That was his fate. And he had to build buildings which he was trying to avoid by being a sadhu. So somehow he couldn't avoid the fate or the destiny. And both his achievement of moksha, jivan mukti, was fulfilled. And at the same time, he did the work that built the infrastructure of the ashram so that many others could enjoy the presence of Sri Ramana. And by being a selfless server and completely egoless in giving everything to God in this act, he was able to end his karma. And that which related to fate rather than destiny, so that he was able to be liberated. And then he did leave the ashram finally after he had completed that work, and he lived nearby, but an ashram actually formed around him, and he became a very great and well-known sage in his own right in his elder days, not his eldritch days, but his elder period, and many conversations have been published that he held with visitors and disciples. So he was able to complete not only his own karma, but he was able to become a teacher and transmit wisdom that even wasn't available through Ramana or through others, through his own having gone through his karma and the learning from unveiling all of his resistances that created great wisdom.
Thank you. So it sounds like the key is the learning process. The key in dealing with the karma is the learning and the
and
acceptance
surrender.
And the surrender.
Yeah.
And then is that, would you say that the that then like when the fate comes into resolution or in alignment with the destiny is when karma in a way has become resolved?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you accept the perfection of it all, even in its imperfectness within the level of comfort, let's say. But because you have surrendered everything, you're receiving bliss that compensates for any adversity in the realm. In the same way, you see, the reason why this approach of non-duality differs from Stoicism, the Stoic wants to be able to endure the adversity of his fate, but he doesn't get the bliss of it necessarily. But that capacity of the Stoic is given as a byproduct of reaching the bliss of the real self, in which one is no longer concerned about the vicissitudes of life of the body, because one's already in the light and disidentified from the vehicle.
Okay. Thank you. I have one more question.
Okay.
I had to deal with something that Vajra said. It was a quote from the book. Something about the soul's desire to understand understanding. And it reminded me of like when we teach intelligence development, this final phase of the capacity for intelligence development. But I was just wondering if you could speak about that capacity or desire of the soul to understand understanding.
Yes, understanding is a very complex and subtle concept. And, you know, it is to stand under and to be in the substance of reality that is the bedrock. But it turns out that there are many layers to sediment upon the bedrock. And so one's understanding deepens. And eventually one recognizes the process of understanding itself as a whole and comes to understand what is intelligence in its absolute nature and then how that absolute nature relativizes itself and ultimately emanates an ego that lacks understanding but thinks it knows everything, you know, whereas there's a total humility of knowing nothing but realizing everything because one is one with all that is. But then in that ultimate state of separation and alienation from the bedrock, no understanding but a sense of power that comes from buying into the illusions and the wishful thinking of the ego, which is what creates karma that one didn't understand and one had to go through in order to get the wisdom to then have understanding of one's, of God's understanding of one's life. Okay. Anyone else with any comment or question? No? Ah, Ken.
Really looking forward to the book, and I appreciated that point on the ego needing narratives in order to sometimes undo itself from certain veils. I know that's the case with my ego. There's a liking for stories to learn from. I had a question about Annamalai Swami and his venture out of the ashram and encountering all kinds of difficulties there. And you said that it was the subconscious, in part, playing up certain events, creating these difficulties, and so that's one of the signs by which one can sort of register through maddictive reasoning that something is, or, well, in this case, isn't the right path. And then you mentioned that it's also the superconscious that works in at the same time, I believe, and also puts in signs in reality. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've been feeling this coming up personally and synchronicities coming up, just hearing certain things that are accurate for the moment. And sometimes I follow it and sometimes I don't. But I was wondering if you could speak maybe a little more to this relationship between the subconscious playing up things and the superconscious, and how one can follow those things accurately.
Mm-hmm. Well, the superconscious is in charge of your destiny. The ego determines your fate. So his ego is not happy in the ashram, mm-hmm. and wanted to leave, but his superconscious says, no, you don't. So that's what rules. And even though his free will, apparent free will, indicated that he could go, but it was a desert when he left, right? No support, total antagonism. He found himself in a hell realm. It wasn't what he expected. And then as he turned back toward the ashram, of course, suddenly everything is beautiful, roses, here's free money, you know, free food, right? So there was a clear separation between how life looked when he was leaving and how life looked coming back. And I think the superconscious is responsible for making that shift that enabled him to see clearly his destiny and his proper decision in that case. And I think in some way, if one's understanding and sensitivity is subtle enough, that kind of signage is present all the time.
Thank you. So it was.
And the subconscious, did that factor in as well in this?
Yeah, the subconscious part of his ego both had a desire for freedom and autonomy, but also there was a superego desire to fulfill his father's injunction to do the building and all of that, right? So there was also that kind of a conflict. He was both running away from it, but feeling guilty for running away, mm-hmm. right? So that compromise formation had to be resolved as well.
Sense. I felt a lot of positive signage when I was coming to the ashram, the whole plane trip and the encounters, so I can testify to that. I won't leave for now.
Okay. Don't ask for free money, though. Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm Rita.
Thank you. I look forward to the book, too.
Okay.
You just mentioned guilt, and I just want to know, when guilt comes up, which is common for myself, how accurately, I feel that I can make decisions, and it's based on guilt, but then how to counteract that in the moment to go beyond that.
Yeah, the ego has a sense of guilt that has nothing to do with real guilt, okay? Because any time that the ego is doing something that the superego doesn't like, right, which is the parental desires and fantasies about you when you were a little child, you will feel guilty, right? That guilt may actually be a sign that you're doing the right thing, right? Because you're transgressing the superego command that you stay small, you stay a child, you follow the rules that they told you, you live life according to their paradigm, and you never go on your own vision quest to discover who you are and what your reality and relationship to God is, right? And to yourself, your real self. So that kind of guilt should not be taken as the will of God that's coming to you. And the ego will often mistake it for that because it wants to be, you know, in a good place with an internalized family system. But once you break free of that, then you find that there's a whole different kind of relationship to reality that now is based on the Dharma or the Tao and not based on a superego that's internalized. And then one will feel guilt if one fails to grow in a situation. Usually the ego guilt is when you do grow and when you do change and become different. This one will be if you stagnate or fail to meet a challenge that you know is necessary as a rite of passage or something like that. So your values will shift and your sense of what is necessary to your higher development will become more clear once you've broken free from the superego. Okay? Okay. Anyone else? Okay.
Thanks. I wanted to ask actually another question about Annamalai Swami. One of the questions you asked during the teaching is, does karma work because of external forces or because of projections? And this story of when he's on the train and then he actually doesn't pay the train fare and he doesn't say anything about it either, right? Or they say, you've already paid, and then he just keeps walking on by. Like, what is one's responsibility actually to be kind of honest and integral in a situation like that? I think it's a minor one, but it also came to mind, like, with fake vax cards and things like that, right? Uh-huh. And if Annamalai Swami was in a pure state of mind and he's not projecting on the situation that this is wrong, it's just something that happens, is there karma that results from actually...
And I don't think this is like a fake... He didn't have a fake ticket or try to cheat the guy. No, he was invisible. He wasn't asked in the first case. And in the second case, he was told, just go. We already gave you the ticket. So, no, that was a clear sign that it was the will of God. So if he tried to argue with the ticket taker, you know, I think then he would have had some bad karma as a result. So I think that he clearly recognized that this was, you know, the Tao moving him in the right direction and telling him, He had made an accurate choice. So I don't think there's karma. But yes, I agree that in other cases where one is trying to go around the rules or break the rules entirely, then one has to make a judgment. Are the rules legitimate? Is there a legitimate authority that I have to follow to do something that is actually against my best interests or against life even? Just because some illegitimate government tells me that. And then one has to have a loyalty to God, not to any human authority that lacks a connection or a divine right to have that legitimate hegemony over your life. And if not, then your duty actually is to disobey, but in a nonviolent way. And to work out ways of escaping from tyranny.
So it's not really external forces or projection. It's the Tao in a way that is creating karma or determining your destiny and karma.
Sure, but that is coming from internally, right? There is the Tao is also projecting the conditions. Right? Why did he have a ticket taker who didn't see him or told him to go? Right? There was some way in which his own energy field was projecting that, and the ticket taker was identifying with that vibrational frequency. And so there, it wasn't just an objective other who was telling him this. It's a dream field, and he's the dreamer of his dream. And so because the superconscious had entered into the dream field, a different kind of unfoldment of the dream took place than when he was going in the other direction. And so that shift in how the dream appears from very negative and paranoid to very full of glory and joy and all of that is a sign that the Tao is, you know, you're in accord with the unfoldment.
Shifting one's state of consciousness actually is what allows all of the karma to come into a higher state as well until there's none
sure.
of this.
But you also have to understand that when you go on a vision quest, you're going to go into a state of challenge and adversity. So you're not going to meet with miraculous signs. You're going to meet with great difficulties for a long period, and you have to endure those difficulties and lack and follow your heart's calling to whatever your mission was given to you from a vision or from your heart to bring into manifestation despite the obstacles. And then you don't take the obstacles as a sign that you should quit, but that you should manifest endurance and stick-to-itiveness until you are broken through whatever resistances there were that are also internally created based on the fear of lack and of your own madness or of your own, let's say, unworthiness to fulfill the mission, whatever might be the obstacles that come up internally until that has all been worked through.
It would be hard to tell the difference sometimes of what's an obstacle that should send you in the other direction. Or
and this is where the understanding of understanding comes in. You have to have a very deep connection to God to often know the truth of that. Did our visitors get anything out of this event tonight?
Yeah.
Was it?
Incredible. And very grateful for your teachings.
Okay. Thank you. How about luck? Was there any light shown for you as well?
I'm just tired now.
I know, I feel the same.
No, I'm grateful for this moment, and I'm looking forward to the book. I resonate with the Greek mythologies.
Oh, yeah? Oh,
classics, yeah.
Wonderful.
And it'll be interesting to hear your translations and how this unfolds. Okay. And yeah, we're
wonderful. Good. I look forward to speaking with you all before you leave.
Thank you.
Vajra, make sure they get copies, okay? Okay. So I hope that this has been useful, and I do look forward to having another meeting once you've read the book, and we can then speak about what were its messages and how they have impacted you. So in the meantime, follow the signs, use your madduction carefully, and go where they're offering you free food and
money.
And money sometimes, or at least scholarships, you know. Make sure that your heart is with God so that you deserve the highest destiny and not the lowest fate. And you'll find that God will, being merciful, arrange for a very harmonious settling of karma in a way that brings great wisdom and the bliss of complete realization of the mind and heart of God as yourself. Thank you all. Namaste.
Namaste.
Okay. No announcements tonight?
I guess I could.